The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. It's hard to believe, but it's already Wednesday. These last couple of days, we've been focusing more on history and the rule of law in Britain, in the United States. And as we've focused on that, have you noticed what's happening in the world? Have you looked at the headlines? I want to start today with what's featured at thetrumpet.com, Tales from an Upside-Down World. This is by Joel Hilliker. He says, the world order is being flipped over like a cheap card table in the Far East, Central Asia, the Middle East, Europe, and elsewhere. But what are the big stories dominating the American media? A man who says he's a woman and a white woman who says she's black. That's what's dominating the news cycle in the United States of America. The so-called superpower of this world, that's the big story. And really, the big story here, from the Trumpet's perspective, is that with that attention, all that attention given to such bizarre and deviant behavior, it says a lot about where America's focus is. Meanwhile, as Mr. Hilliker brings out there, the world is being flipped on its head. This was in the Washington Times yesterday. This headline, 121 murders attributed to illegals released by the Obama administration. The piece says more than 100 immigrants whom the Obama administration released back into the community went on to be charged with subsequent killings, according to government data released Monday, that raises more questions about whether immigration authorities are doing enough to detail illegal immigrants awaiting deportation. It says later, all told, 121 immigrants who were held, but eventually released by ICE, went on to commit homicide-related offenses from 2010 through 2014. That's just over the past 5 years. Now, some of this might be attributed to incompetence, but some of it also has to be attributed to just gross negligence on the part of ICE, on the part of Homeland Security. But really, whether it's negligence or incompetence, isn't it more important? Isn't the story itself more important than a man who calls himself a woman? I mean, even here in the UK, as much as it also has turned inward, I would think if over the last 5 years, 121 illegals murdered that many Brits, I would think it would be a pretty big story here on the BBC. Why isn't this a huge breaking news story in the United States? I mean, Americans are being killed, murdered by felons, by gang members that are being set free by the United States government. I want to take you back to President Obama's address. Now, this would have been in November, so 6-7 months ago, when he came out with all the executive action that he was going to take to solve the immigration crisis. And here's how he began his speech to the nation.
When I took office, I committed to fixing this broken immigration system. And I began by doing what I could to secure our borders. Today, we have more agents and technology deployed to secure our southern border than at any time in our history. And over the past 6 years, illegal border crossings have been cut by more than half.
It all sounds so good. More border agents, fewer border crossings. It sounds like this administration is tough on illegal immigration. But it's exactly the opposite. I mean, this is an administration that will not enforce the immigration laws that are already there in place. I mean, I think both sides can agree that there needs to be some kind of reform. But what about the laws that are in place right now? This is an administration that has been delaying deportations. And as you see from this story I quoted from just a few moments ago, an administration that simply has released dangerous criminals right into American society.
That's why over the past 6 years, deportations of criminals are up 80%. And that's why we're going to keep focusing enforcement resources on actual threats to our security. Felons, not families. Criminals, not children. Gang members, not a mom who's working hard to provide for her kids.
And so what about the 121 that have been set free and that have since committed murder? And that's just the worst of the bunch that have been released, as Jeremiah Jacques brings out in his forthcoming article in The Trumpet, the worst prison break in American history. That's what this amounts to. He says, and again, this is coming out in the Trumpet magazine in just a few weeks. Mr. Jacques says, during the 6 years Mr. Obama has been in power, the Department of Homeland Security has knowingly released some 195,900 criminally convicted illegal immigrants onto America's streets. That averages out to about 85 convicted criminals released per day. These are criminals that the government has knowingly released. And then as Mr. Jacques brings out in his article, these are statistics that the DHS has worked diligently to cover up, as these independent agencies have had to take them to court just to get the information released. 195,900 criminally convicted illegal immigrants set free onto America's streets. And then the government working to cover up the facts. And then when the facts finally do come out, they started coming out in March. When they finally do come out, then there's the virtual blackout in the mainstream media. The same media that just obsesses over these bizarre stories. Why won't the media report the truth about the immigration crisis? Just last week, Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson, he gave a speech at Rice University, I think it was June 8th, and he echoed many of the same points that President Obama brought out in that November speech. The title of Mr. Johnson's speech, Immigration, Perception versus Reality, What's Really Happening? And when you listen to representatives of the administration, well, you'd think that everything's just going great. And then you see reports like we saw yesterday. 121 murders, or tens of thousands, criminals being released. This is from Jay Johnson's speech. He said, apprehensions on the southern border, which are a direct reflection of total attempts to cross the border illegally, have declined significantly over the last 15 years and are a fraction of what they used to be. In fact, and of course you can't even look at apprehensions itself just to show how many are attempting to come across the border illegally, but leave that aside for a moment. Just look at the apprehensions, the numbers, the total. Last year, 487,000. The year before that, a little bit less, 421,000. The year before that, quite a bit less, 365,000. And then the year before that, 340,000. In other words, it's gone up every year by a significant margin. So what he said at Rice isn't even the truth. He said later, this is Jay Johnson, illegal migration into this country peaked in the year 2000, reflected by over 1.6 million apprehensions that year. So the peak was in 2000 and everything's just kind of settled down after that. Is that the truth? Has it dropped considerably since 2000? And if so, why are all these criminals roaming the streets? These illegals who are convicted criminals, why are they roaming the streets of the United States of America?
I've seen the courage of students who, except for the circumstances of their birth, are as American as Malia or Sasha. Students who bravely come out as undocumented in hopes they could make a difference in the country they love. These people, our neighbors, our classmates, our friends, they did not come here in search of a free ride or an easy life. They came to work and study and serve in our military and above all, contribute to America's success.
Well, it all sounds good, but as Mr. Jacques brings out in his article, the facts show that the president's outreach program to illegals, it's drawing in all kinds of people who want to hurt the United States of America, who are killing Americans, criminals spilling into the streets. In a column that came out just the other day, this is from Pat Buchanan, is Third World America inevitable? He writes, over three decades, that border has been a causeway into the USA for millions of illegal immigrants who are changing the face of America to the delight of those who think the country we grew up in was ugly. A lot of people are delighted by this. A lot of people, even in the administration, who think that the old America was ugly and that we need this kind of change. We need this kind of mass immigration. We need amnesty for all of them. It says all sides of this quarrel have been using the figure of 11 million people here illegally. In her new bestseller, Adios America, Ann Coulter makes a compelling case that the real figure is close to 30 million. If that is true, and if the next president embraces amnesty and a path to citizenship for illegal immigrants, that will mean the end to America as the Western nation we have been. That will mean the end. This is the kind of thing that Americans need to be hearing about. They need to be reading about it in their newspapers. They need to be hearing it discussed on nightly news programs. What a change. What a dramatic transformation we're seeing. He quotes Coulter, Mr. Buchanan does. Coulter, who wrote, Roe v. Wade can be overturned, Obamacare can be repealed, amnesty is forever.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Only two origins of this vast universe are possible, creation or evolution. And yet, the existence of a creator and the doctrine of evolution oppose each other. They cannot coexist. It seems many, regardless of which source of origins they believe in, more or less assume their beliefs. Many have also been swept into their beliefs based on the circles in which they have lived or associated. In general, the beliefs of peoples on this most important subject have been established without proof. Could this have happened to you? Is it even intelligent to believe in a creator? Was mankind the product of millions of years of evolutionary forging? Regardless of which, should we accept our views on blind faith? People generally believe what they are willing to accept, and most are not willing to prove either. Is there a way to irrefutably prove either possibility of origins? Evolution has been pushed onto the educational community as if it were fact. But does evolution stand up to an objective examination of the facts? And will you accept the challenge to find the proof of the Holy Bible? Proof in the God of creation? Proof that the Holy Bible is the inspired revelation from the all-knowing, all-powerful maker of the universe? Our booklet, Does God Exist?, examines these vital questions and also the stunning answers. Download or order it for free at our website, thetrumpet.com, today.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
The popular stories in the American news cycle today show how the home of the brave is becoming the land of the free from reality. That's from Joel Hilliker's article posted today at thetrumpet.com. It's like it's a big reality show for so many people in the American news media. And then when you look out and about and see what's happening, this other piece at thetrumpet.com today, Russia will retaliate if American troops are stationed near its border. You might have seen headlines on this just yesterday. This from CNBC. Russia warns of new military confrontation in Europe. These are not, again, shadowy networks of terrorists, mind you. Russia is warning of new military confrontation in Europe. The article says Russia-West relations took a downturn this week when Moscow warned that any stationing of military equipment along its border with Europe could have dangerous consequences, and President Vladimir Putin announced that Russia would add more than 40 ballistic missiles to its nuclear arsenal this year. So, I mean, this comes at a time, leave aside what the United States announced over the weekend about stationing, you know, or having a small presence there in Eastern Europe. But here Putin comes out and says, we're going to add 40 ballistic missiles to our nuclear arsenal. And it comes at a time when, as I covered yesterday or the day before, the U.S. Navy is being reduced to pre-World War I levels. The Air Force is shrinking. The Army and Marine Corps being diminished. And then there's Britain. Its military presence has been rendered feeble against world threats, according to its top military leaders. And Russia, meanwhile, is on the march. Russia is adding to its nuclear arsenal. And yet look at what most Americans are caught up in. This is from the Associated Press, quoting the Russian Foreign Ministry, who announced yesterday, or that organization announced, the United States is inciting tensions and carefully nurturing their European allies' anti-Russian phobias in order to use the current difficult situation for further expanding its military presence and influence in Europe. That from the Russian Foreign Ministry from late Monday evening. The announcement said, we hope that reason will prevail and it will be possible to save the situation in Europe from sliding toward a military standoff, which could entail dangerous consequences. Here's Russia talking about a military standoff with Europe. Here's Russia and all that saber rattling. And given what's already happened in Ukraine and elsewhere, I think there's probably more than a few Europeans that are sitting up and taking note of what Putin is saying. Now, Europe has its share of problems, to be sure. This is from a Reuters piece on the Greece crisis. It says Athens now has 2 weeks to find a way out of the impasse before it faces a 1.6 billion euro repayment due to the International Monetary Fund. You might remember from last week, the late last week, all the negotiations over how to bail out Greece, and those talks ended. It goes on and says, potentially leaving Greece out of cash, unable to borrow, and dangling on the edge of the currency area. It says Germany and other creditor nations demanded that Athens come to its senses and offer new proposals. Germany's EU commissioner is now saying that Europe needs to prepare for a state of emergency. And now we've said all along, we've been saying for many years, for decades, that a financial crisis is what will unite the prophesied European beast power under the leadership of that prophesied strong man, the Daniel 8 man. We've been talking about this for many, many years. Europe, yes, has some things to sort out still. Looking at the economy here for a little bit more, this is from the Washington Examiner. Speaking of the U.S. economy, Budget Office, U.S. debt picture has worsened dramatically. This, according to Tuesday's report, coming from the Congressional Budget Office. This comes right out of Congress. Talking about, as we've heard that word used so many times before, the unsustainable course that the United States is on. This Examiner piece says Congress's Budget Office again warned that the U.S. faces a massive debt problem Tuesday, using stark language to describe the government's long-term mismatch between spending and revenues. A big mismatch. You've probably seen other headlines of late about how the government's taking in more revenue, more money, more taxes than ever before. And yet it still can't keep up with spending, out-of-control spending. This article says the long-term outlook for the federal budget has worsened dramatically over the past several years. In the wake of the 2007-9 recession and slow recovery, the Congressional Budget Office reported in its long-term budget outlook for 2015, released on Tuesday. Now, that office, the CBO, projects the federal debt to rise from 74% of economic output, which is what it is today, to 103% by 2040. It talks about all of the spending programs, health care, retirement, interest payments on the debt, which, of course, those are going up and up. And if you look, and I alluded to this just the other day, if you really get into the facts and the figures of this reckless spending, the problems in the United States are far worse than for Greece. You look at the size and scope of this problem in the United States, and then, like I mentioned yesterday, at just how fast you can see the deterioration or destruction even of these great institutions. It's happening. It's happening fast. It still may be hanging by a thread, but that's about all that's left. I want to comment also on this Michael Oren piece. This is from the Wall Street Journal. The title, How Obama Abandoned Israel. And it mentions how that both of these leaders in the United States and in Israel, President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu, how they've both made mistakes. But according to Oren here, he says only one purposely damaged U.S.-Israel relations. Only one has purposely damaged the relationship. Well, which one do you suppose it is? According to Michael Oren, again, this is the former Israeli ambassador to the United States. He served between 2009 and 2013. I mentioned the other day he has his book coming out in just another week or two, titled Ally, My Journey Across the American-Israeli Divide. And he also comes from the middle, in between the conservatives and the liberals there in Israel. He's not what you would consider to be a hard right representative or observer. But he says in this opinion piece, nobody has a monopoly on making mistakes. When I was Israel's ambassador to the United States from 2009 to the end of 2013, that was my standard response to reporters asking who bore the great responsibility, President Barack Obama or Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, for the crisis in U.S.-Israel relations. There is a crisis in this relationship, and it is significant in terms of Bible prophecy. We've gone through this before. But coming back to Oren's comment, nobody has a monopoly on making mistakes. That was his standard response and so on. He said, I never felt like I was lying when I said it, but in truth, while neither leader monopolized mistakes, only one leader made them deliberately. Here again, it was on purpose. Now, it's a pretty serious charge to make. But remember, it's coming from one that really leans more to the left than Netanyahu or others in Netanyahu's government. But he's alarmed, Mr. Oren is. He's alarmed by what he saw during those 4 years in office. Continuing from his article, it says, from the moment he entered office, Mr. Obama promoted an agenda of championing the Palestinian cause and achieving a nuclear accord with Iran. Such policies would have put him at odds with any Israeli leader. This isn't just a personal thing between President Obama and Netanyahu. Any Israeli leader would have been up in arms over these announcements, over these decisions, over achieving some kind of nuclear accord with Iran. Oren talked about how Israel was just totally blindsided by President Obama's Cairo speech in 2009. He mentions in the article how that typically Israeli prime ministers would receive a copy of the speech ahead of time. But in this case, totally blindsided. And you know all about President Obama's Cairo speech, the Muslim outreach, the unprecedented support that he showed for the Palestinians during that speech. This is just a few months into his first term. And basically, in that one speech, he recognized Iran's right to develop nuclear power. That's the way his administration started. And now here we are in 2015, on the verge of this deal, which essentially allows Iran to just coast to the finish line without any interruptions, without any resistance. I mean, much has been made about Prime Minister Netanyahu's speech before Congress in March and how it offended the Obama administration. It was disrespectful. It was politically motivated. But if you go back to June of 2009, what a shock the Cairo speech was for the Israeli government. What a shock. What a jolt that was for Prime Minister Netanyahu. Iran has a right to pursue nuclear power and develop it. Continuing from Mr. Oren's article, it says, similarly, in May 2011, the president altered 40 years of U.S. policy by endorsing the 1967 lines with land swaps, formerly the Palestinian position, it says, as the basis for peacemaking. If Mr. Netanyahu appeared to lecture the president the following day, it was because he had been assured by the White House, through me, that no such change would happen. And so the White House assured Mr. Oren, that's not going to happen. We're not going to just give you the Palestinian line. There's no such change. And then it comes out, and publicly, the policy is reversed, and Israel just has to deal with it. It says finally here, in 2014, Israel discovered that its primary ally had for months been secretly negotiating with its deadliest enemy. The talks resulted in an interim agreement that the great majority of Israelis considered a bad deal with an irrational, genocidal regime. See, it's not just one Israeli leader, as he brings out in his column. It's any Israeli leader that would have been up in arms. And as he also brings out here, all of Israel, for the most part, considers this a bad deal. Not just Prime Minister Netanyahu, all of Israel, which is why this American administration is so unpopular in the little state of Israel. The other day I mentioned that column by John Poderitz in the New York Post, speaking of Mr. Oren and the book that he has coming out, saying, I'm not sure that in the annals of diplomatic history there's ever been anything quite like this astonishing account of Oren's 4 years as Israel's ambassador in Washington. It's not that there's a lot of breaking news in Ally that will startle people. Rather, it makes news on almost every page with its incredibly detailed account of the root hostility of the Obama administration toward the Jewish state. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream is available at kpcg.fm. Email us your feedback. Just write us at td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. The relatively new science of archaeology, the digging up and study of the material remains of man's past, has confirmed without question the historical accuracy of the Bible. Solid, documented evidence, apart from the Bible, confirms events and persons that at one time were known to us only from Scripture. The Bible is real, and you need to pay attention to it. Call now and request your free copy of The Authority of the Bible. This lesson, which comes from the Armstrong College Bible Correspondence Course, blows the dust off your Bible. You will learn how to mine the treasures buried in the greatest book on earth. You can discover its secrets and enrich your life today. For more information, please visit thetrumpet.com. Trumpet Daily.
4 years ago, 5 years ago, we knew nothing about writing in the kingdom of Judah from the time of David and Solomon. So some people claim that they are mythological figures that never existed. And here, by archaeological discoveries, we are accumulating data on the period of David and Solomon. And the four inscriptions, and this is the last one and the best of the all four, indicating that writing was quite well distributed at the period. So historical memories could be documented and preserved from generation to generation.
That was Yosef Garfinkel, an archaeologist from the Institute of Archaeology at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, talking about a 3,000-year-old inscription that was recently discovered just outside of Jerusalem with the name Eshbal on it, also known as Ishbosheth in the Bible, that name anyway. This archaeologist believes it belonged to a different Eshbal, but still from the same time period. This from Haaretz in Israel. What's in a name? Rare inscription from King David's era found outside Jerusalem. The article says, together with similar findings, the discovery of a name on a 3,000-year-old clay pot has changed the understanding of how prevalent writing was in the kingdom of Judah. I mean, we're talking about a pretty significant and sophisticated society, in other words. A lot of scholars, more modern scholars and historians, want to try to minimize that significance, that influence. But we're talking about a pretty sophisticated and well-advanced kingdom. The article says this is the first time the name Eshbal appears on an ancient inscription in Israel. A little bit later, the correspondence between the biblical tradition and the archaeological finding attests that this name was common only during this period. And then finally, the fact that Ishbal's name was inscribed on a large clay jar implies that he was an important man. Now, they don't believe, as I say, that he was the actual one mentioned in the Bible, but certainly that it came from the same time period. It makes me think of all the seasons that we've spent in Jerusalem, digging with Elat Mazar's team and making fantastic findings that have contributed to this rich historical legacy that's in the ground in Israel, in Jerusalem, in the areas around Jerusalem. So much of that history has come to life in recent years with many of these excavations. The last news story I just want to draw your attention to here before we conclude is one from The Atlantic talking about teenagers, young people. And just to bring it back to what we started with on today's program and what young people are being subjected to and what they are hearing or seeing or reading, even from distinguished news outlets. What a world our young people are growing up in. This piece says, teenagers are losing confidence in the American dream. The article says, what a difference 15 years makes. In the 1990s, those loosed upon the world after high school graduation faced a booming economy and relatively sunny job prospects. More recently, high school and college graduates have faced less hospitable conditions. A study published recently in the Journal of Poverty juxtaposes adolescents' perceptions from those two eras, and the results, while qualitative and limited by their small sample size, suggest that young Americans' outlook on social mobility has gotten bleaker. Well, why would they be more bleak on their future, on opportunities, on the road ahead? As views on self-advancement changed over the decade and a half, so did views on the advantages of having lots of money. In 1996, high schoolers were more likely to feel that wealth wasn't a ticket to happiness, and a lack of opportunity might even have character-building advantages. If I was rich, I could see where it could come easy just to take it for granted, one participant said. And that was, of course, back in the mid-1990s, just 20 years ago. By contrast, the article says, the 2011 group tended to think that wealth made people happier overall because it affords them material goods, such as Apple laptops, that would give them the respect and attention of their peers. See, for many young people now, it just boils down to things. Just having the money to be able to get the gadgets. And yet look at what so many of our young people today are struggling with. This particular article made me think of what Mr. Armstrong said in The Missing Dimension in Sex. This is a book that he originally wrote way back in the 1960s. And he said on page 150 of that book, why all this violence? Well, just to set up this quote, he also just talked about how our society, how it's a teenage-dominated society where you have all of these influences revolving mostly around sex and violence, and how it's the young people that are really the driving force behind it. But he says, why all this violence, this immorality? Here is the cause. He says, human nature, which is vanity, without any purpose, an absence of parental training and discipline, this is the cause for all the violence and the immorality that you see. Just the obsession over deviant behavior of every kind. It gets back to human nature, the pull coming from Satan the devil. And just too, a hopeless, bleak state. He said, without any purpose. And then you add to that that there's no education and training, no discipline. Let's go through just a few verses in Isaiah chapter 1. And that I'll just give you one more quote from Missing Dimension. Mr. Armstrong expanding on that point about just the general hopelessness among the youth. He says, there's no sense of purpose today. We are told we must adjust to living in a world of problems with no solutions. Nuclear war, the erasure of human life from the earth, appears to be just around the corner, liable to strike us any second. Again, he's writing this from way back in the 1960s. He says, young people today are given nothing to live for, no hope, no future. They are more prosperous than ever before, but they're bored. They're rebellious. The spirit of revolt is in the air. They resent all authority. There's big problems. Big problems in the family. Big problems among young people. Big problems in school, in academia. Big problems in the nation as well. Isaiah 1 and verse 2 says, hear, O you heavens, and give ear, O earth, for the Lord has spoken. I have nourished and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me. See, God's brought up children, and we've rebelled against God. The ox knows his owner, the ass his master's crib, but Israel does not know. My people does not consider. Here God's comparing us. to these stupid animals, basically, saying, look, even they know how to get back to their owner. Even they have an awareness of who's over them, who's supervising them. Verse 4, ah, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a seed of evildoers, children are their corruptors. They have forsaken the Lord. They have provoked the Holy One of Israel unto anger. They are gone away backward. Children here, I mean, this refers to the descendants of Israel as a whole, not just to young people specifically, but the whole society. It's in decay. It's about to be ruined. Why should you be stricken anymore? Verse 5 says, you will revolt more and more. The whole head is sick. The whole heart is faint. From the sole of the foot, even under the head, there's no soundness in it, but wounds and bruises and putrefying sores. They have not been closed, neither bound up, neither mollified with ointment. Sickness, you see, from head to toe. And you can see it by looking at what kind of news stories get the most attention. You can see that there's a spirit behind it, a spirit of hostility, a spirit of division, a spirit of gross immorality, of radical individualism, materialism. That's the big problem with education today. It's just all about materialism. It's just all about, well, if you do go through it, you go through it for one reason, to get money so that you can have the things. Because if you have the things, our young people are being taught, if you have the things, you'll be happier. And never have we been so unhappy. All this wealth and prosperity, all of these gadgets and things, all of this misery and suffering, this gets back to the great paradox of our day. Mr. Armstrong talked about this so much. You see, all of this increasing advancement in technology and a corresponding advance for evil, for deviance, for perversion. Verse 7, your country is desolate, your cities are burned with fire, your land, strangers devour in your presence, and it is desolate, as overthrown by strangers. My father, of course, has expounded on this recently in the Trumpet magazine, the cover feature from the July issue, I believe. Verse 9, it says, except the Lord of hosts has left unto us a very small remnant, we should have been as Sodom, and we should have been like unto Gomorrah. See, except for a very small remnant, look around you, look in our society. It's exactly like Sodom and Gomorrah. But there is hope in this very hopeless age. It's sad when you look at what's out there and think about how do you bring up young people in a society such as this? Well, you have to really look to God, and you have to be constantly on guard, vigilant, as a parent. A very small remnant it talks about here. There is a small remnant on this earth today, fulfilling God's will, performing exploits for God, reaching the world with a message. An unpopular one, but nevertheless, reaching the world with a message of hope. A message of hope. That's why this work is here. That's why this radio station is here. That's why Armstrong College has been established in Edmond, Oklahoma, teaching young people from all over the world about the soon coming educational system, the soon coming kingdom, the soon coming government that's to be set up on this earth, all over the earth. not just in a couple of locations. Everywhere, God's college today truly is a vision of the future. Armstrong College is a vision of the future. The content on this radio station, it's a vision of the future. Our website, whatever else you want to add to the list. There's a small beginning. There's a mustard seed beginning with anything that God builds through human beings. But it is spreading. Mr. Armstrong said back in December 1965, the future welfare and even the existence of civilization is dependent on the educational system. The future welfare of civilization depends on education. Now, you look at where this world is today, the kinds of topics that are dominating the news cycle in America, and then all that's happening around the world. And you have to go back, as far as root causes go, you have to go back to the education in this world. My father's even commented on this before. I have a quote here from 2003. This is 12 years ago. He said, the education of this world is leading to catastrophe. You look at all that our young people are being exposed to. Well, the worst of it's right there on the college campus in most cases. But there is hope. There is hope for a better world. There's no hope for this world. There's no hope for this world's system of education. But there is hope in the lone educational institution that God Himself raised up. It's in Edmond, Oklahoma. And that message, that vision, is spreading. So many of those young people that go to God's college are themselves actively engaged in the work, actively supporting programs like this, involved in all that this work produces. And when you project ahead, after the return of Jesus Christ to this earth, when the family of God is in place, administering God's law, administering the government of God, then institutions like Armstrong College, they're going to be popping up all over the place as God begins the long and difficult process of building a new world, God's kingdom. Tomorrow, I'm going to be talking, hopefully, if I can spend enough time on it this evening, I'm going to be talking about going back to some of the history there with the British Empire and Napoleon's defeat at Waterloo. We're coming up on that anniversary as well. So make sure that you tune in again tomorrow morning or afternoon or evening, wherever it is that you happen to listen to this program around the world. And also, coming up here just at the top of the hour, don't forget about the Trumpet Hour with your host, Joel Hilliker. I'm Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. We'll see you again tomorrow.